Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're almost all here. Jason is working on a client deliverable, so he is off for the day. But I've got Matt Kachansky, manager on our SIU investigative team, working on a pretty large process improvement project for one of our SIU clients, and Wade McFall, a member of our investigative SIU team. I am Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse. And while my t-shirt says I'd rather be watching NYPD Blue, it's not true. I'd rather be here with you guys.
Not true.
It is not true. So today I think we want to circle back and revisit some of the conversations that we have a lot that have to do with medical necessity from the investigative and the SIU perspective. And we want to talk about, you know, some of the differences in the way medical necessity cases are worked and looked at, and some of the methodologies, but also just some of the mindset from an investigative and a process improvement perspective. You know, and medical necessity cases are generally cases that at least the U.S. government in prosecuting criminally typically does not like to get too involved with because of the differences of opinion. You know, medical necessity cases fall into a couple of categories. The things that providers do in which it is really straight out not medically necessary. You know, my example I like to give is you go to the doctor because you have a sinus infection or a sore throat, and the doctor does an EKG. You know, where's the medical necessity for that EKG inherently built into what the foundation behind what you're there for? But then you have other instances, you know, that have to do with medical necessity from a clinical perspective. Like, for example, you know, there was a window of time where interventional cardiology was the flavor of the day for investigations at plans and at the OIG. And the question of occlusion of a cardiac vessel and whether or not that cardiac vessel needs a stent or not. I bring this up because our April LinkedIn Live, we're going to be spending about an hour talking to two lawyers that I worked with here on a very large project involving a interventional cardiologist who was criminally prosecuted for what was essentially either a civil dispute or a battle of the experts. And so it got us to thinking about how that intertwines in the SIU space from a fraud, waste, abuse perspective. And I think if we're talking about this from a, you know, strictly from a, you know, a service rendered that had a lack of medical necessity versus this battle of the experts, from an investigative perspective, you really need to be able to make that call quickly for ROI purposes, for investigative management purposes and the like. But I want to start with you, Wade, because when we're talking about medical necessity, you've got these two areas, right? Mm-hmm. One is going to be a battle of the experts, and the one is this is clearly just to pump up a bill. And as long as there isn't a patient harm factor, because you get into patient harm on these, you know, there could be a differentiator. But, you know, you get these cases all the time. When you were at the OIG, we would get them all the time. You look at them now from the SIU perspective. What are some of the things that you're looking at? And what are some of those considerations that you're taking into effect in making some of these decisions about, do we pursue it? Do we refer it to some other department, or do we just shut this down and say this isn't, the juice isn't worth the squeeze?
Well, I think generally if it comes down to an expert against expert, that like as you indicated, that's a really tough case. So like at the OIG especially in Los Angeles, and all the judicial districts are different, that may fly in a lot of, you know, different districts, but it wouldn't in Los Angeles. And as we were talking about before, I was kind of fortunate that I was in the Los Angeles region, but we had offices in, you know, in Phoenix and Las Vegas and San Diego, where the cases were not, you know, the same as they were in Los Angeles. So if we could get some kind of nexus in those judicial districts, we could probably, you know, work it from there where the agents there, frankly, they didn't have the same type of cases that we were working in Los Angeles. So I guess I'm getting kind of off of that, but the expert on expert was really tough, and we wouldn't open those in Los Angeles. I just had too many other cases where there were services not rendered, or if it was a medical necessity issue, it was like you were describing, there was a lot more space between what should have happened and what actually did. So we didn't really work those. We, as I've discussed before, we had other avenues that we could work stuff. So we might take it to, you know, if we could work it with the Mafuku, with the DOJ attorneys, with the state, you know, we had other options to work it, but as far as taking a case that was going to be a medical necessity expert versus expert to the U.S. Attorney's Office, we didn't even waste our time because they're not going to work that.
Right. And what you're talking about a little bit is, you know, at the OIG, there was the ability to reallocate resources, right? If you had an agent that was a little underassigned on their caseload or was in a different part of the region, but they have the ability to do some of the work on the case, you can reallocate resources. You know, obviously what we're all learning out there, and, you know, I hate the phrase do more with less, because it's impossible to do more with less. What you can work to do is achieve the same with less, right? That's, you know, you really can't do more with less, but particularly I love when people say 110%. Well, you can only give 100%. So, but even within the SIU space, I think because resources tend to be in some cases as limited or more limited, but, you know, it's not like you can say, hey, you know, I'm at plan A and this case is an important case, but we're too busy. There's no one else to give it to, right? You can't ship it off to someone else. So it really becomes an important piece of the investigative case vetting process, right? So it's making sure that, is this really a services not rendered case that is a little bit more clear and obvious? And that isn't necessarily clear and obvious when you first open it. But, you know, obviously if you've got somebody where you look and you see their diagnosis is a sore throat and they got an EKG, like, what's the, you know, maybe there's a non sequitur, so maybe you look at it. But if it's something where you're talking about doing something like putting a stent in on something where there's a battle of the experts, you have to take kind of a second look at that. So Matt, so I want to go to you, because this goes into kind of a combination of that resource allocation and then from that process improvement perspective, but it also gets down to, and Wade kind of alluded to, using those resources, which equates in our space to hashtag return on investment. Sure. And, you know, part of that argument is, you know, let's start even from the UPIC perspective, right? CMS is constantly asking for more of whatever it is, right? So your feet are to the fire. And I know we talk a lot about what's known as the MCC, the major case coordination, and this whole premise of how some cases make it through MCC to go on for investigations and others don't. And this, you know, I use the phrase all the time, this push-pull, but these differing opinions or views, and medical necessity becomes one of the top ones. Now, just as kind of a related aside, if you just go in and do an internet search for medical necessity CMS program integrity manual, medical necessity is referenced in multiple chapters of what's known as the PIM. And the definition of medical necessity from the CMS side, it works. When I read it, it's very heavily centered upon documentation. And so is it a documented service versus a battle of the experts? But that all falls in with that resource allocation, that vetting, and that ROI.
Yeah, the definition is, you know, did the documentation in the medical record support the medical necessity of the procedure that was billed? And, you know, that could be a battle of the experts as well. You know, as, you know, in the UPIC and with the SIUs, you've got to look at the breadth of the medical necessity. Is it an invasive procedure where there's risk of, you know, there's risk to the, or abuse of the patients? You know, is it, you know, with putting in a stent that's unnecessary? That's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty invasive procedure going in. It's cardiac surgery. You know, are they, you know, if they're not necessary, that's a pretty big challenge for the patient. The other is, is the medical necessity related to some other activity, such as the optometrists that are billing the TCDs because, oh, they just bought this big expensive piece of equipment and they want to use it. It's a revenue generator for them. It's outside their usual sphere of specialty. So those types of decisions, when you get these complaints, what's the specialty? What are they doing? Is there something going on behind the scenes that would cause them to do that? That's going to allow you to make those kind of determinations up front, whether those cases should be open or not. You know, sometimes it's going to be as simple as, you know, they're doing these things because they're being paid to do them by another doctor that's referring them to patients. So there's kickback situations. You don't know that up front, but you've got to look at the data to see whether or not, okay, they're all, now they're doing all, they're spiking in this procedure. Oh, look, all the patients they're receiving are coming from this one source. So let's take a look at this a different way. So you've got to take the totality of the circumstances in when making those decisions.
And let's just stay on that for a minute, because the premise of a medically unnecessary procedure in an office where we're talking about, like you talked about this with optometrists or ophthalmologists with transcranial Doppler, TCD, right? And, you know, I worked last year, we here at Advise, I was working on a project involving a self-disclosure involving an ophthalmologist who bought a machine to do the TCDs. And he relied upon the billing and coding advice given by the manufacturer on you need to be, if you're going to do this service, this procedure, the patient has to have this diagnosis as the primary diagnosis. Well, this provider had, none of his patients had ever had that diagnosis. All of a sudden that machine comes in and they go here. Now, he did the self-disclosure, disclosing this as part of other behavior. So it was, you know, while kind of like, you know, oh, while I'm under the hood changing the oil, I'm going to change the spark plugs. Like, I might as well admit that I've done this as well. And that becomes a factor, right? So the data analytics can in some ways help you to understand the medical necessity piece of something. You know, I remember working a number of cases at the OIG and even here involving a procedure called enhanced external counterpulsation, EECP. It's a G code, G0166. And I remember it because it's a very, very specific policy on when you can do it. The patient has to have a stage, it was either stage two or stage three angina where they weren't a surgical candidate. It's 35 sessions once or twice a day, 5 days a week for the length. And what I noticed in doing some of the projects here and when I was an OIG agent is patients didn't have a diagnosis of unstable angina until they got their first service. So all of a sudden they got this diagnosis of it. And like, how does that miraculously occur, right? And the data can show you that. You would expect the person to have had a diagnosis of unstable class three angina at least one or two visits before associated with an E&M, right? Which they didn't have. So I want to stay on this a little bit, because the other piece of this puzzle then becomes medical necessity relative to prior authorizations. Now, for those that work primarily in the Medicare space or the Medicare Advantage space, you know that prior authorizations in the traditional Medicare space are really limited. There's only a few. You know, there were some pilot projects that were done with non-emergency, non-routine ambulance transports. There are some OIG studies that showed unbelievable savings to the program as a result of medical necessity with regard to these transportations. But we see it a lot in the MCO space. We see it a lot in the commercial space. Prior authorizations, and then instances of denials after a prior authorization was hit for medical necessity. So, and I know, Matt, we talked a little bit about this, about the ROI that's needed, that you're spending all this time, effort, and energy to have your provider do a prior authorization, and then all of the time, effort, and energy to approve a prior authorization, right? It's done electronically. There's platforms, there's compliance issues, and then you turn around and get a denial, and and there's medical necessity based on that. So that's a whole other wrinkle to an investigation where you've got a prior authorization, a provider does the service, and then they get denied, and then they end up in the payment integrity issue.
Yeah, and I've seen the full gamut of the prior authorization perspective, where some SIUs and some plans, they see prior authorization, they won't touch the case. Even if the data is showing them this stuff is just way over the top, like, well, they got prior auths in place, you know, we're not going to touch it. To the prior authorization has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. It, you know, it's based on whatever the provider told the plan at the time. So that could have been a falsehood. You don't know what process was in place to approve the prior authorization. Was it just a paperwork shuffle? Or did they actually look at medical records to determine if that patient needed the procedure or the equipment or not? So I think when you get a case that involves prior authorizations, you need to look at what happened behind the scenes in requesting that prior authorization and approving it before you make a determination on whether to move forward or not.
Right. And we know that in a large sense from the payer side, payers will often say when you appeal, and I've seen this, where providers get a denial and the provider then appeals the denial based upon the prior authorization, and the payer will say prior authorizations are not a guarantee of payment. It's a condition to seek payment. Right. Yeah. But it's certainly a piece of the puzzle. So, Wade, I want to go, as we kind of run out of time, I want to get to you for the last word, because Matt brought up a really good point, which is that when you have an instance in which a provider has a prior authorization in place and then there's a denial, from an investigative perspective, how do you look at a prior authorization? Does a prior authorization that results in a denial, are you taking, you know, when you see that, does the fact that there's a prior authorization say, hey, maybe I'm not interested in looking at this case? Or maybe do you say, if there was a denial after that prior authorization, is there something, what was the nature of the denial? Why would a denial occur? From an investigative perspective, I think I'm torn about how to treat that, right? Because the payer has been alerted to the fact that there's going to be a claim for this item, service, or procedure that required prior authorization. And then you go and you get that prior authorization, and then lo and behold, you get a claim that's denied. And now you have this argument that goes on. From an investigative perspective, I'm torn about how I would treat a prior authorization.
Yeah. And again, it goes back to which district you're in, because that's in Los Angeles, that's for sure not a criminal case. You're never going to, you know, the first thing you think of is trying to prove intent. You're not going to be able to do that if they have a prior authorization. They're acting kind of, at least their justification will be that they're acting on good faith. It was prior authorized, so that, you know, they're moving forward with that. You might be able to work it civilly, or even, you know, with a CMP or something like that. But as far as criminal, like in the Central District in California, that's, it just wouldn't fly. So again, it goes back to having all these other cases that they will take. It's a matter of doing, again, like you said, the doing less with more, that doesn't work, you know, or doing more with less doesn't cut it. So you have limited resources, you have more cases than you can work. So it becomes a matter of triaging them and saying, well, this one's not going to make the cut criminally for sure, right, because I have all these other cases. So, you know, maybe civilly, but criminally it just wouldn't. It wouldn't fly.
Yeah. I think the prior authorization piece, thanks for bringing that up, Matt, because it really does throw a huge wrinkle in sort of the whole issue of the medical necessity. And you know, granted, if you've ever dealt with prior authorizations, it's essentially the provider calling the plan up and saying, hey, patient XYZ needs to have a colonoscopy. They're 53 years old. The guidelines say it, you get that prior authorization, right? And then later on, there's a denial. And so the argument could be, hey, we're authorizing, the prior authorization is to earmark the money. Should it be paid based on facts we knew at the time? But, you know, are you given good facts? Are you given bad facts? Are you given no facts other than this patient is 53 years old? You know that payer because they're a member of your, you know, of your plan or what have you. So it really does throw an extra wrinkle in. So for those of you that are, you know, kind of struggling with this as well, take a read online of the CMS PIM, take a look at how it's referenced multiple times, the importance of medical necessity. Clearly, you know, there are arguments you can make from even in a documentation perspective. You know, when we're talking about, for example, something like evaluation and management, E&Ms, where a documentation auditor might deny a claim at that level and say there was no medical necessity for that claim at that level. Now, it's important to understand that, because it's not that an auditor is saying that there wasn't medical necessity for the E&M. The argument is that the documentation as written didn't justify the level of that service, item, or procedure. And that's a huge difference, that you have to be able to understand that from a documentation perspective, because you see that a lot in the E&M space, the term medical necessity with E&Ms comes out. You know, meeting the requirement for a medical necessity for an E&M is you've shown up to the doctor for an office visit. You've met the criteria for medical necessity. You've gone to the doctor. It's really more about the level of that service. So there's a lot that goes with that. And I think it's an ongoing discussion. Again, in April, we're going to be spending a fair amount of time talking to two lawyers who worked on the criminalization of a medical necessity case involving stent placement. It's a very interesting tale. I think people will get a lot out of that. As always, guys, great to see you guys. Again, for those of you that are listening, watching, and enjoying these podcasts, please continue to let us know of topics and ideas that we can present to you on these OIG roundtables. And again, if you're not getting our newsletter, feel free to shoot us an email at hello@advisehealth.com. You get your newsletter to your inbox every Friday afternoon. You can click right onto the OIG roundtables. You'll be able to get old OIG roundtables, our recorded LinkedIn lives off of our YouTube channel. You just go up to YouTube, look for Advise Health, subscribe, and you can get that content delivered to you as a subscriber. So again, good seeing you, Matt. Good seeing you, Wade. And thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.
Thank you.